The Drew Marshall Show, Canada's most listened to spiritual talkback program.
Well, each show, the moment I look forward to is our journey segment. Basically, it's our opportunity to talk to just normal everyday folks about messy spirituality. And it doesn't get any messier than this, folks. Rachel Barkey is a wife and mother of two young children who, after 4.5 years of fighting breast cancer, has recently been diagnosed with terminal cancer. So what's it like to possibly be facing your last Mother's Day with your husband and kids? I mean, can you imagine that scenario? And what kinds of things do you spiritually wrestle with? And when do you stop praying for healing? Or do you? I've got a lot of questions for Rachel, and she joins us today. Rachel, happy Mother's Day tomorrow.
Oh, thank you very much, Drew.
You've got a beautiful soft voice there, way over there in British Columbia. Yes. That's where you're at? Where are you in BC?
We're in Vancouver.
In Vancouver.
Right in the city, yeah.
And where were you born and raised?
Actually, in Southern Ontario. I was born in London. My parents went to school there, and that's where I was born and raised. So Ontario is as home as Vancouver is, actually.
Ah, yes. London, Ontario, the armpit of Canada.
No, that's a bit further south, I think, actually.
Oh, that's right. Well, you've got quite a story, and I think, your story came to my attention with good friends. We have mutual friends, the Barlows, Mike and Tina. And I'm in a sort of a home group where we get together and talk about God stuff once in a while and have a good feed and a couple of beverages. And they brought up your scenario one time when we were praying. And I saw your family picture, and it just choked me up because it seems unfair. It just seems unfair. So instead of starting off with the chronology of events here, let's start off with the unfair aspect, because I think that's what everyone resonates with when they hear that you're 37, mother of two,
yeah,
and you've got this cancer thing that is just absolutely attacking you. It's unfair.
Yeah, and I get that a lot, actually. People it's not the way it's supposed to be.
No.
I suppose is what it all comes down to. And my parents raised me to, you know, that life was never promised to be fair. You know, that was sort of one of the things we grew up with. And so it's not not to say that it's not a shock and that, you know, it doesn't seem unfair, but I guess it's more, rather than the why, it's sort of sometimes, you know, I ask myself sometimes why not, you know? And I think that's maybe even a better question, because bad things happen. And so even though it's happening to me, it's not, I don't actually ask myself why very often. You know, it is unfair. I'm not happy about it, obviously. But I don't know. It's just life isn't fair, and I think everyone can look at that and sort of see that's true. You know?
Okay, what about Neil? Because sometimes the person who's afflicted with it can sort of,
yeah,
I don't know. God seems to wrap them up in some kind of a mercy blanket or something. He seems to have a special hand on those who are the afflicted ones, but the loved ones around the afflicted, they're the ones that can get, yeah, set off pretty easy and maybe slip into a rage factor.
I have said many times that this would be a lot harder, actually, in some ways, if I was in Neil's shoes. I feel for him and his situation is a lot more difficult in some ways than mine is, especially as a Christian. I have hope, and I know, I know where I'm going. I know that something better waits for me, but definitely having to watch my husband watch me suffer and, you know, what faces him being a single parent afterwards, and then, of course, my kids. It is the hardest thing about this for me, for sure, is watching my husband and my kids having to walk through this, because I've said if I was single, not that it would be easy, but it'd be so much easier, you know, than having to watch my husband and my family suffer because of what I'm going through.
Sure, sure. Yeah. All right, well, let's jump back to 2003. You're 32 years old,
yeah,
and this is when the original diagnosis comes with breast cancer. Can you take us back to that day?
Yes. I was, we had recently moved back to Vancouver. We'd been living in the States for a while. We'd moved. We'd had a baby. I was pregnant. And we were starting a business. Basically, every major stressor you could have, we had. I would joke saying, you know, all we need is for someone to die, you know, and we had all the bases covered.
Sure.
And then I had Kate and started our business and then that spring I was weaning her and I found the lump. And I always wondered how you'd know. I thought, you know, you're just like, what's a lump, you know, like what does that mean? But when I found the lump, I knew it wasn't supposed to be there. It was hard as a rock, and that, so I went right to the doctor, and things happened pretty quickly because I was young, and yeah, it was cancer, and it was the most aggressive form of cancer. It was, and so, you know, I had surgery within 2 weeks, and then chemotherapy for 6 months, and I reacted quite violently to chemo. I had to be hospitalized for my treatments because I was so sick, and my reaction to the drugs. And, of course, you know, everything that goes along with that, losing your hair and, you know, the whole nine yards. And then, and then I had more surgery after that because I really, at that stage, my kids were so little. My son, Quinn, was 2, and my daughter, of course, was just, you know, turning 1, sort of right in the middle of my chemo treatments. And I wanted to be as aggressive as possible because I just thought, I actually didn't really have any concerns that I would beat it the first time around. It was kind of weird. It was obviously a very serious situation, and I got that. But, you know, the numbers are so good, you know, in a lot of ways for breast cancer that I really did sort of feel like, you know, I just got to get through this. And so I had bilateral mastectomies just preventatively to make sure that I gave myself the best shot at it not coming back. And, you know, have been on hormone therapy, taking a pill every day to sort of reduce my chances of recurrence again. And so that was sort of the last 4.5 years. And then I again, also found out my cancer was genetic, and so had my ovaries removed again in an effort to reduce the chance of recurrence. And so basically did everything I possibly could, and even more than my doctors recommended, because my doctors weren't even recommending, you know, a lot of these options I chose. Because they didn't necessarily think it was necessary, but I was just adamant. I wanted to be here. I wanted to watch my kids grow up and be a mom and a wife to Neil, and so did everything we could. And, yeah, 4.5 years later, got the news that we didn't want to hear, obviously. So,
all right. I've got to ask you the question about having your ovaries removed and both breasts removed. Mm-hmm. I mean, the first thing that jumps into people's head is, you know, that's a pure assault on your womanhood.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, so how do you recover from something like that? I don't know if this is too immature of a question to ask, but did it take away your femininity? You and I, we talked about, you know, shooting straight here, right? We're gonna do this in this interview. So let's talk about how that affects, you know, your love life, and how did Neil respond? And my goodness, there's just so many awkward, intimate details when a woman has her ovaries and breasts removed.
Yeah. Well, I think two things, I guess. One, first of all, I have an amazing husband who was so incredibly supportive and affirming and gentle and was just, just everything you would want a man to be when you're going through a journey like that. My husband was and is. And so in a lot of ways, I don't, you know, I feel like I had the best set of circumstances to sort of deal with that. Not to say that there weren't struggles. Obviously, going into menopause at 34 with 2 toddlers, you know, didn't exactly help the sex life very much, I would say.
But more,
I think, you know, these are just, everyone has their own circumstances they deal with. And I'm a doctor's daughter, so, you know, I get that a lot of women, I volunteer with the Cancer Society and have counseled other women sort of in their decisions to have mastectomies and make some of the same decisions I've made. Not that they would make the same decision, but just so that they understood why I made my decision so they could choose for themselves. For me, I wasn't really attached to my breasts in the sense that they defined me as a woman. I was just like, this is bad tissue, get it off. I just didn't want, and I wanted to reduce my chances of recurrence. And the same thing with my ovaries. We had made the decision to not have any more kids at that point, so, you know, that wasn't sort of a consideration going forward. And again, ovarian cancer is so hard to detect. By the time you find it, it's often too late. And so for me, it really all came down to what is going to give me the best chance of living longer. And so, yeah, there are side effects in terms of, you know, the decision to go into menopause and not feeling as attractive because I've got, you know, 13 scars on my body from all the different surgeries. you know, and losing your hair and, you know, all those things definitely come into play. But I would say generally I didn't feel any less a woman because of those decisions I made, and, you know, bottom line, I guess.
We're chatting with Rachel Barkey, and Rachel, we talked about events following 2003, the initial diagnosis, and now we're going to kind of jump up to Christmas 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Lay this one out for us.
Well, we actually went away for Christmas, and I got the flu. And so I was really sick when we got to our destination and sort of thought, oh, a couple days, I'll sort of lay low. And did, but I didn't seem to be getting any better. And so then I didn't want to sort of waste the holiday. So I, you know, went to the drugstore and loaded up on whatever I could find and just sort of, you know, was taking all the medication I could take to sort of make myself function just by, you know, not feeling so under the weather. And then my kids got the flu. So I thought, you know, when you've had cancer, there's always this what if, you know, and every little twinge, every little sickness, you're kind of like, ooh, what if, you know, what if this is the cancer coming back?
Yeah.
But then my kids got the flu, so, you know, that what if went out the window that time. And but we got back from holidays, and my kids got better, and I didn't. And I was, you know, the stuffy nose and stuff had gone away, but I just still felt achy and fluish. So I finally went to the doctor, I guess about 3 weeks after my original symptoms, and went to the hospital, and literally within, I guess it was within 24 hours, they'd done all the tests and then just told me they thought initially it was my gallbladder that was making me sick. But once they had done the ultrasounds and the CAT scans, they said, no, it's not your gallbladder, it's your liver. And as soon as they said that, I knew that the cancer was back. And that's when we found out that it was in over half of my liver, the cancer had returned, and was in every bone in my spine. And obviously that was January. So now it's spread even more extensively since then. So it's everywhere at the moment, and obviously continuing to grow because there's nothing they can do to stop it. So.
Okay. So the prognosis. I mean, I was chatting with someone recently about this story, and mm-hmm. they actually got a little defiant about it. They sort of said, because I use the phrase, and I don't know if this offends you or not, but I use the sentence that I used in my intro, which is possibly facing her last Mother's Day.
Mm-hmm.
And this lady kind of rose up and got all defiant and sort of said, no, how dare someone say that? There are, you know, the natural things, and try this and try seaweed and, you know, all the stuff that everybody's got. I'm not even sure what the question is here. I guess you must have tried everything. You've got people coming out of the woodwork giving you lots of advice.
Oh, yeah.
When do you just resign yourself? And is that giving up? I don't even want to use the word resign to saying, okay, that's it. It's a matter of palliative care now.
Well, I am palliative, and people, you know, it's interesting to me. That's been one of the most fascinating parts of this journey, is just seeing how other people react to my news. You know, it's not even so much about me. It becomes about them even, and just in their grief and their inability to sort of deal with death and the reality of it. And as soon as I got the news, I knew I was palliative. I mean, I knew that there was no way they could cut it out. They couldn't treat it anymore. I'd failed on all the treatments they'd already given me that I'd been taking, you know, for the last 5 years. So, sorry, I was trying to think what the question was, but it was...
I don't even know what the question was.
but, you know, so I think there's a line. I mean, I have hope. I definitely have hope that I could be healed. I have a big enough God that can do that. He's done things that are way more incredible than that. So it's not that I don't have that hope that that could happen, but realistically, he's also allowed this to happen. And you know, so I'm not being unwise or trying not to be unwise in terms of which treatments I accept and decline, but there is also that balance of, at least for me, I don't want to spend the last days and weeks I have running, chasing the wind, essentially, you know.
Right.
I want to spend it with my husband, and I want to spend it with my kids, and I want to spend it with you know, people I love, and enjoy the time that I have, rather than constantly running around with this idea of what if, in the other direction, in terms of what if this works, what if that works, what if this doesn't work. So it's hard. It's hard to make those decisions, because there are lots of very well-meaning people who tell you they have the cure for cancer, you know, but we've had to sort of I think wade through is probably the best term, you know, all the different options that are presented to us and think through them each carefully. And obviously some we accept and some we discard. And ultimately we just trust that, you know, it's going to be the Lord that does it one way or the other in terms of healing me or not. And we just have to rest in that.
Rachel, how much time have they given you?
You know, they don't tell you. They're sort of really careful to sort of not put timelines on it. But given where my cancer is and how extensive it is, they basically have said 3 to 6 months. I'm at 4 months now, actually, from my original diagnosis. But, you know, there's stories of people who live for a year, even 3 years. Every situation is different. So we really don't know. We don't know.
You're spending almost, I would say, a good portion of every day in bed. Is that right?
Yes, yeah. Because my cancer's, the liver cancer makes you very tired and very nauseated, or the cancer in your liver, and then and the bone cancer is extremely painful. So that's probably what keeps me bedridden, is just the fact that I have bone pain everywhere, literally, in my body. So it's just, I just have to rest an awful lot between the fatigue and the pain. So,
Rachel, the choices that you are facing, again, I'm trying to figure out the right words to use here. I was going to say, you know, in your final days, but that just could be maybe the wrong phrasing.
No, it's okay. We're shooting straight, remember?
Okay. All right. People, I would say, imagine that. They say, okay, if I was given, you know, a couple of months to live or whatever, what would I do? That whole bucket list scenario. But more importantly, how do you spend that time with your kids? How do you spend that time with your family? What do you do to invest, and what do you do to leave legacy? And do you do things like film video of yourself and a message to your children that they can watch forever in the future? Or do you have time? Do you have energy? Do they have the creativity to even do such a thing?
Yeah, that's a good question. I have done some of that stuff and tried to be intentional about that. You know, I've written letters for each of my kids for them to have on their wedding day. And I've done videos, just sort of things like my best friend sort of did a couple of interviews with me just on stuff like how Neil and I met, you know, so that the kids will be able to hear my side of the story and how we got together. And just recollections of, you know, our wedding day, my recollections of the day they were born. Just a few little things like that, you know. I don't want to be creepy with it, you know, and
right.
sort of, I don't know, it's, the reality is I'm not going to be here, and I can't be their mother for, you know, all those things that I maybe want to be here for. So I've sort of picked and chosen the things that I thought were more significant and would be meaningful to them down the road, that they would have something from me, you know, in my handwriting, or just something that they'd be able, we have obviously video camera and able to sort of just get some more things on video so that they can see my face and, you know, hear my voice. You know, where they maybe wouldn't have had that before, you know, or they obviously won't have it in person.
Hmm.
So I've definitely done those sorts of things. But I think more it comes down to just really, you know, in some ways, not a lot has changed. I probably say yes more to my kids in terms of, like, can I have a cookie? You know, and I'm like, yeah, sure, go ahead, have a cookie, right? All the things that I'd sort of be more anal about before, I'm kind of like, whoa, what's the big deal? Go ahead, you know, kind of thing. You know, but those are on the non-moral issues. On the moral issues, you know, nothing's changed, and we still parent the same, you know, and nothing's really changed day to day on that, and we're really trying to keep it as normal as possible for them, because they're still quite young. They're 6 and they're still 7 and 5, and they don't, as much as they get it, they don't really get it, you know. So
yeah, well, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, Quinn is 7?
Quinn is 7. He just turned 7, yeah.
And Kate is 5, so that's exactly what I was going to ask, was, you know, how much do they really comprehend what's going on here?
Yeah, you know, they talk about, like, we talk about it freely with them we brought it up and obviously talked to them about it, but we have waited too for them to bring it up, and they do occasionally. Even last night, Kate was saying to me, she said, you know, I was lying with her in bed just before she fell asleep, and just said, you know, she said, Mom, I don't want you to die. And I said, oh, honey, I don't want to die either. And so we talked about that a bit, and then just talked about the hope. I said, but I'll see you again, you know, on when you come see Jesus. She said, I'll be there waiting. And, you know, so we talked about that, and then she just made this little comment, which struck home to me just in terms of that she may get more than I maybe realized, because she just said, but, Mom, she says, I'm going to miss hearing your voice. And I just thought, oh, you know, that's when it's hard for me. That's when it's really hard for me, is with the kids. you know, I want to be their mom, you know, and that's when it's really hard for me, is when I see it affecting them. So.
Wow.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, let's don't worry about it at all. I got nothing. Seriously. I wish I knew you. I wish I knew you more than just this interview. Because God seems to use people like you in a salt and light power kind of way. Salt and light tiny, but salt and light powerful. You're no big somebody. You're just a normal schmuck like me.
Yeah.
And yet I wish I'd gotten to know you better, because the stuff you're exuding as a result of this experience is the stuff we all need to lap up.
Hmm. Oh, thank you. That's very kind. I don't take any credit for it, quite honestly, because it really is Jesus. Jesus and me, because I couldn't walk this road alone. I couldn't do it at all, quite honestly, without his strength. It's, you know, these experiences have a way of distilling someone down to who they really are and to their core and what they really believe and what they don't really believe. In that way, I said this with my first diagnosis, you know, even though it was a horrific experience with all the surgeries and, you know, especially my experience with chemo, I don't want to go through that again. I would never want to go through it again, but I was very grateful for the experience because of what I learned, you know, through it. And you know, in the same way, grateful for this experience too, in a really sort of twisted kind of way,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, sure, sure.
But I hope you understand what I mean when I say that.
Okay, let me ask you one final question.
Mm-hmm.
Might be a little unfair, but if you knew that you were going to, well, okay, I've got two questions. Would you rather know when you're going to die, or would you rather not know when you're going to die?
Ooh, would I rather know when I'm going to die, or would I rather know not know when
yeah,
I'm going to die?
Yeah. In other words, would you rather know a certain, like, this is the day?
Yeah.
Or would you rather not know?
Well, that's a really good question. I don't know if I have an answer to that. I think my answer would be yes. I think my answer would be yes. I would like to know. It's kind of like I'm going on a trip. Someone used this example with someone that they lost, that they loved, and it's like they're going on a journey. You know, they're just getting a head start on everybody else. You know, so in some ways it feels like I'm preparing for a journey. So like all these, you know, things I'm doing for the kids, like I'm, you know, packing them for school or, you know, getting them ready for camp or something, you know, all these things that they need. And that's one of the things we've definitely struggled with. When I use the phrase wade through, is like, how do you prioritize, right?
Yeah.
How do you prioritize, when you don't know the timing, how do you prioritize who gets to come and visit and when and what kind of conversations you have? You know, Neil and I have talked about that in terms of, are we having enough serious conversations? But we don't want everything to be super serious. We still want to live and love and laugh and enjoy each other, you know. And then activities, you know, for me it's also, you know, when I'm in pain, how much to complain versus not to complain. You know, there's a lot of things that you really don't know. And if you knew you had 6 weeks versus 6 months, you'd make different decisions. Mm-hmm. So in that way, I'd say probably it'd be easier just to know what the drop dead date is.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Pardon the pun.
No, 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 that's fine. No, I admire your cheekiness. I had a pint last night with a friend of mine whose wife was killed 3.5 years ago on a snowmobile accident.
Oh.
And you know, we were just sort of reminiscing and, wow, where did that time go? And I remember that day, I mean, very vividly when I phoned his house just to see what was going on and touch base, and he had told me that Joanne was just killed on her snowmobile. And so I contrast those two, your story and her story. Her gone in an instant, no one knowing when she was going to go versus knowing that you're going to be going sooner rather than later. And I wonder about that. That's all.
Yeah, well, and you know, Neil actually was the one who said to me, and I thought it was a great point. He just has said a couple of times he's so grateful for the fact that we've had this time, and I totally agree. You know, like we've had a chance to cry together. It's been very sweet time for us the last few months, because you obviously value the moments you have together so much more profoundly, you know, because you actually have this knowledge. And you know, we get to have the hard conversations, like he has even asked me, what do you want me to know, like, in terms of helping the kids, or, you know, being, he's like, I know how to be a dad, but I don't really know how to be a mom, you know, so asking those kinds of questions in terms of what's important to me as a mother, you know, in terms of raising our kids. So, you know, like, we've just been able to have great conversations about stuff like that, and think through stuff in terms of what our priorities are in terms of parenting and even our marriage, just because we have that little bit of foreknowledge. Sure. I mean, we don't know. I mean, I could get hit by a car later on today. No one knows when they're going to die.
No, well, okay. But, Rachel, that leads me into my final question, which is, if you knew you were going to die tomorrow, what has to get done?
Nothing. I feel very content that, and, you know, in some ways I don't think that's necessarily changed with my diagnosis. I mean, like I said, I'm grateful I've gotten to do all these things for the kids and you know, make a few memories, that kind of thing. We've taken a couple trips. But, you know, when it comes down to it, it is all, whether it's Neil or my kids or me, it's all about our relationship with Jesus and the fact that we have hope because of what he's done for us. And so in that sense, you know, whether I had died suddenly or, you know, we're in the situation we're in, it really doesn't make a difference, because ultimately this life is short, and it's not ever, we've never been promised that this is all there is. We're promised so much more. And so like I said, when we get distilled down to what what's important and what's not, that's what's important to us. And ultimately what should be important to everyone. So I wouldn't change anything. I don't think I'd do anything differently.
Rachel Barkey, I hope that God freaks you out tomorrow on this on this Mother's Day. I hope that you and Quinn and Kate and Neil just have some kind of memories.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it'll be a very different Mother's Day in some ways, but, you know, ultimately it is, you know, it's for the kids. I'm not, you know, I know it's, there's been a lot of laughs, you know, over the last couple of months, but we're just going to have a good day. They're, you know, making cards and doing stuff like that. It'll be a good day for them. So I'm really glad I'm going to be able to be here for it. So,
thank you. I mean, seriously, this has been a highlight for me. I mean, you'd think Marie Osmond would be a highlight, but
oh, I was a big Marie Osmond fan growing up. That was so great.
Were you listening online?
A little bit, yeah.
Okay, good. We had a great time with her, but this has been the highlight for me today. Thank you. I feel ripped off that I didn't get to know you. I feel ripped off that our life paths didn't cross earlier.
Thanks, Drew. That's very kind.
Bless you, Rachel.
Thank you. Have a great day. Have a good Mother's Day tomorrow as well.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Rachel Barkey on the Drew Marshall Show. Yikes. If you just tuned in, Rachel is a 37-year-old wife and mother of two young children who, after 4.5 years of fighting breast cancer, has recently been diagnosed with terminal cancer. And that was a tough one. That was a tough one. Please pray for that family, the Barkeys. And live tomorrow like it could be your last.